This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When politicians talk about race, they often use coded language that may cover some underlying racism. Think of labels like welfare queen, illegal alien, and thug. These coded phrases enable a politician to send clear cues to an intended audience without using racial epithets. We call it dog whistle politics, and for decades, it was the staple of political rhetoric. Question now is whether it is changing in the politics of Donald Trump. Joining me now is Ian Haney-Lopez. He's a professor of law at UC Berkeley. He's the author of the book Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. He's going to be speaking tonight at Page Auditorium at Duke University and participating in a forum tomorrow at Duke called Policing Color, Black, Brown, and Blue. But first, he joins me in the studio. Ian Haney-Lopez, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what we mean. Again, kind of a fuller description of dog whistle politics and what we're talking about.
So if you think about a literal dog whistle, it's a whistle that human ears can't hear because it blows at such a high frequency, but dogs can. And so it's a metaphor for political speech that's operated on two levels. On one level, silent. On another, producing sharp reactions. So if you think about illegal alien, welfare queen. On one level, they're silent about race. They don't explicitly mention race. They certainly don't use a racial epithet. But just underneath, they're provoking sharp racial reactions. They come with very strong racial imagery. Those are dog whistles.
And what about the origins of this? I mean, I suppose coded language is always a part of politics. But with regard to race and kind of in the modern era, where do you trace its roots?
It really comes out of the 1950s, the 1960s. It comes out of the civil rights movement. So two things happen that are relevant to dog whistle politics. One, the nation's sort of mores begin to change, and the use of explicit racial language in politics becomes disfavored, becomes a mark of immoral backwardness. And so all of this language that had been explicit, now it needs to change. It's being repudiated. At the same time, the fact that race relations were changing created a surge, a wave of anxiety among many whites that made race more important than ever, and especially concerns about integration. So in the 1950s, 1960s, you see politicians looking for a way to plug into racial anxieties without using explicit racial language. And so one of the first examples is going to be states' rights. So states' rights, on its surface, no mention of race, sounds like an abstraction, pretends that the issue is federal-state relations, when everybody understood that really it was a way to say southern states had the right to resist federal mandates that they integrate their schools. It was all about race, but expressed in non-racial language. That's where dog whistling comes from.
And once the courts and the Congress had weighed in on those questions and civil rights and fair treatment under the law did become the law of the land, finally, for a moment in American history, then the code changes not to states' rights but to law and order. And maybe why don't we do this now, because I want to play Richard Nixon, and here's kind of the voice of law and order, and I'll have you talk more about it. This is Richard Nixon.
We shall reestablish freedom from fear in America so that America can take the lead in reestablishing freedom from fear in the world. And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, they're And here is the reply. Our goal is justice. Justice for every American.
There we go. Richard Nixon in 1968 in a campaign speech. He seems to be aware of the fact that this is maybe that somebody has already detected the code, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of what dog whistling was trying to do was it was trying to hide the turn to race baiting from the national critics, from people who are saying, hey, racism is immoral and has no place in public life. And so politicians were searching for a language that they could use that would afford them plausible deniability, that would allow them to say, I'm just talking about law and order. You didn't hear me say race. Therefore, this is not about race. I want to add a couple of points here, though, about Nixon and law and order. This, too, is coming out of the South. Part of the way that the South responded to the civil rights movement was to say that these people who were staging sit-ins and lunch counters, who were marching in the streets, that they weren't heroes defending civil rights. They weren't Americans insisting on human dignity. They were common lawbreakers. They were criminals. And so what you get in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s in the South is this tight linkage between black activism and criminality. It goes back even further, but it's very potent political language in the 60s. And Nixon seizes on it. He's part of this effort to shift the conversation around to away from demands for equality to a notion of black criminality as a threat to the country.
And so that's what he's picking up on. And we now know because of former Nixon aides, John Ehrlichman, who says explicitly, we were targeting African-Americans in that law and order campaign. It was a deliberate effort to criminalize African-Americans.
And he goes on to say, but we couldn't attack them directly. So we attack them as criminals, right? And so, and here's the other point that I want to make: when dog whistling arises, it arises because there's a sort of a grassroots anxiety among whites about changes in race relations. But it would be a mistake to understand dog whistling as only responsive to that anxiety, because once our political leaders start barraging voters with warnings about dangerous minorities and about an encroaching federal government and about a breakdown in law and order, that doesn't just respond anymore to the flames. It fuels them.
Well, and it's pushing, and it's making a push in other directions that go beyond race but still have at the center, race at the center of them. Let's move on to Ronald Reagan now, who famously targets the welfare queen as the problem with federal spending.
In Chicago, they found a woman who holds the record. She used 80 names, 30 addresses, 15 telephone numbers to collect food stamps, Social Security, veterans benefits for four non-existent deceased veterans' husbands, as well as welfare. Her tax-free cash income alone has been running $150,000 a year.
That's Ronald Reagan, 1976 campaign speech. I'm talking with law professor Ian Haney-Lopez, who will be speaking tonight about dog whistle politics at Duke University. Tell us more about that.
This quote is so important. It's dog whistling in the Nixon sense of using a code, welfare, as a way to reference blacks. But even more important, there's a really critical shift here that happens with Ronald Reagan, because Reagan isn't just demonizing blacks at this point. Who's the real enemy here? It's government. It's government because of the way it's wasting money on undeserving blacks, money that it's taking from hardworking whites through taxes. It's government which also should be resented because it keeps insisting on civil rights for blacks or on integration or on equal pay for women. What happens here is that dog whistling takes on this additional character. It's not just fear people of color. It's resent government. And finally, it's trust the marketplace. So on the basis of this story, Reagan asks for tax cuts, and he enacts tax cuts that transfer over the 1980s $1 trillion of wealth, not to middle Americans, but to the top 1%. And so what we've seen is that dog whistle politics is inseparably linked to a dynamic in which more and more white Americans have turned against the idea that government has a role to play in protecting everybody, that government has a role to play in providing routes of upward mobility and regulating the marketplace and providing a decent education, and that instead we ought to withdraw from government in a way that ultimately has allowed government to be hijacked by the corporations and by wealthy dynasties. And that's who government serves now. But these two phenomena, rising wealth inequality and a government that serves the very rich, a rigged economy on the one hand, and racial fears and racial resentments and a realignment of our political parties on the other, these two are completely linked.
Yeah, and it's an amazing trajectory, too, because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce had been at this project for a long time. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce had been trying to erode confidence in the U.S. government since the 1930s. Fear about the New Deal and whether or not we would become a socialized economy mobilized the Chamber of Commerce. And of course, Ronald Reagan, famously a spokesman for one of the chief members of the Chamber of Commerce, GE, he's speaking for them and making these speeches. Government is the problem. The marketplace is your source of happiness. It has less traction until we can make this link between federal programs, which had been seen as working class programs, helping workers protect their rights, helping poor women, single women, get the money they need to feed their children. Once we link this to black families and black women, suddenly the connection was made, and the kind of rhetoric we see, that's when the change is effective.
I think that's exactly right. Welfare through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, it still had a positive connotation because it was associated with helping whites. And it did help whites overwhelmingly. It was designed to do that. That was part of the compromise that Democrats had to make in order to enact these programs with the support of Southern Democrats, that the programs would be structured in a way that whites were the overwhelming beneficiary. And at that point, widely supported. But once they begin to open up and once the color line is dissolved, it creates a wedge for conservative business interests to come in and say, you know, these programs that you thought were good for the working people, they're really just handouts to undeserving blacks. Turn away from progressive government that helps people. Trust instead the marketplace.
And that is what led to this wedge then led to the possibility of Ronald Reagan turning the state around and this siphoning of $1 trillion of wealth from the middle class to the upper 1%. And this takes place, it begins in the 1980s.
It begins in the 1980s, and it describes the trajectory of our country for the last 40 years. This is what we've been doing. And we now have levels of wealth inequality we haven't seen in 100 years. Why? Why did we turn our back on the notion that government should foster growth for everybody? Because significant segments of the American electorate came to believe that growth wasn't for everybody, that those were undeserved, or that those were unwarranted handouts to undeserving people.
Now, lest you believe that it's only Republicans who use this kind of language, Hillary Clinton herself, I think, in many ways accelerated or perpetuated this kind of dog whistle politics and some of the fears associated with it in this 1996 speech.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
There we go. Super predators there. I'm talking to Ian Haney Lopez. He'll speak tonight at Duke. He's the author of Dog Whistle Politics. Super predators, nothing about race there.
Hmm. So what had happened was that the Democrats came to understand that dog whistling wasn't going to go away, that this grassroots anxiety that starts in the civil rights movement wasn't simply going to burn itself out. They saw the Republicans using race successfully through dog whistle campaigns, and they made the fateful decision to imitate them. They said to themselves, if we can't beat them, let's join them. So Bill Clinton introduces himself to the country as a new Democrat. And what does he promise to do? End welfare as a way of life, crack down on crime, cut federal spending. And all of those are Republican themes. I mean, whose way of life is it? And who are the criminals? And why is government suddenly the enemy? And so what we hear with the super predators comment is Hillary Clinton coming in with that same sort of rhetoric. Fear crime. And fear crime is a way for politicians to say to white voters, we understand your anxiety. We're here to protect you. The biggest threat in your life comes from people of color. Now, notice at the same time, distancing itself from people of color, as the Clinton administration does, they have to also distance themselves from liberalism. Because it's precisely liberalism and care for people of color that have been linked in the public imagination. So the Clinton administration at the same time begins to walk away from labor, begins to walk away from working people, begins to endorse trade, begins to endorse programs that are good for Wall Street. All of these are of a piece. You cannot simply walk away from people of color in this dog whistle world. You've got to walk away from a government that actually cares about working people.
And this is an interesting outgrowth and one that we don't emphasize enough in terms of the Southern strategy. Yes, it did turn the Republican Party into the party of the white man. Quite clearly, this is out of the Goldwater debacle. But this is what it did. The Democratic response was, so therefore, those of you who are people of color, you've got really no choice anymore. And therefore, we can, by the 1990s, pander to the fears of a white suburban voting class. And if you're Latino or if you're African-American, who are you going to vote for? Are you going to vote for the Republicans or is it us?
That's right. And you see Clinton saying, essentially, I'm not as bad as Reagan. And in fact, I'm going to make these small gestures of kindness and respect to the black community. I'm going to go on the Arsenio Hall show. You know, I'm going to have a black advisor. And that alone was enough to create, I mean, relative to what had been going on, to create a sense that, no, he really does care about the black community. But in fact, his politics was designed to win election by pandering to white fears. And an awful lot of baggage and damage came along with that. And I want to emphasize this point. Almost invariably, when we talk about racism in American life, we talk about harms to communities of color. But the story we're telling here is racial fear in American politics wrecking the middle class, including for whites. That this is so important for whites to see how racial manipulation in electoral campaigns has actually been disastrous for working class and middle class whites.
And that loss of the middle class is what made us vulnerable to a totalitarian style leader like Donald Trump, who apparently has abandoned the dog whistle. Let's listen.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
That you'll recognize the voice of Donald Trump. So have we ended the period of dog whistle politics? Just let's call them rapists and druggies.
I don't think so. So dog whistling was always intended to do two things. One is to hide the racism from the critics, but the other was to hide the racism from the base. And this is what Donald Trump is still doing. And I think this is so important to emphasize. We are not a country of bigots. Donald Trump voters are not a sort of a mass of bigots. I think that we have to be clear. There is resurgent white supremacist style racism here. I associate it with figures like Steve Bannon, who are quite self-conscious about promoting an ideology of white exceptionalism. But that is not the great majority of Trump voters. The great majority of Trump voters really firmly believe they're not racist. They believe that racism is immoral, and yet they're susceptible to narratives of racial fear. And so Trump is still using those narratives, talking about rapists and drug dealers and saying, but notice he's also that this is a problem of immigration or of refugees or of religion. He is not, to pick a more pointed example, a David Duke. So David Duke begins his campaign for Senate in Louisiana in 2016 by saying, I'm here to represent the interests of Euro-Americans. That's no dog whistle. That's straight up, I'm here to represent white people. You never hear Trump saying that. So he's still speaking in code sufficient enough to let his audience, his base, believe that it's not racial fear that's motivating them. Of course, at the same time, most of the critics say, hey, you know, when you start calling Mexicans rapists and drug dealers, that's race baiting. Did it hurt him? Here's, I think, part of the genius of Trump. He recognized that having cultural elites criticize him as a racist actually helped him with his base. Because one thing a lot of whites fear is that they are the new racial victims. And that one form of racial victimization of whites is false accusations of racism. So when people accuse Trump of being a racist, many of his partisans turn around and say, that just shows that people look down on us because we know we're not racist. And when you say one of us is, that just proves he's one of us, that they're against us, and that we're the ones who are actually embattled and being victimized in this country.
Has this rhetoric taken a turn, though? Is it different in kind than it has been in the past decades?
Absolutely, because I think in the past decades, dog whistle candidates, campaigners, you know, you think about someone like Mitt Romney, even someone like Newt Gingrich, they didn't want to be called race baiters. They didn't want to be seen as demagogues by the coastal elites, right? And so Newt Gingrich will say something like, you know, Barack Obama is the best food stamp president in history or whatever. But at the same time, he's not going out and saying Mexicans are rapists. Right. I think the difference is Trump doesn't mind. And in fact, he welcomes being criticized and despised by coastal elites. That helps build his populist credentials.
Talking to Ian Haney Lopez, a professor of law at UC Berkeley and the author of the book Dog Whistle Politics. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
He speaks tonight at 5:30 p.m. Page Auditorium, Duke University, also participating in a forum tomorrow at Penn Pavilion at Duke called Policing Color, Black, Brown, and Blue. Just ahead, we preview a new documentary about the life of a veteran teacher in North Carolina. Please stay tuned.